Hi, my name is TJ Myhill. I'm the moderator for this panel, although I know for a fact that with this panel I'm not going to have to do much. So I'm an attorney here in Atlanta, and I deal with intellectual property, First Amendment issues, technology issues, and basically just here to provide legal insight and legal answers to questions, although no legal advice. I'm not your lawyer, and I don't mean for anything I say to be something that you are taking away and using without consulting your own lawyer for your own legal advice. With that, I'll go ahead and have my panelists introduce themselves, and then we'll go ahead and get started.
All right, thank you, and good morning, everybody. Thank you for coming out. 10 o'clock on a Sunday morning at Dragon Con. I appreciate the effort that all of you put into being here. There's a lot of other things to do, and I'm glad you're interested in the right to be forgotten. I am Kurt Opsahl. I am the Deputy Executive Director and General Counsel at the Electronic Frontier Foundation, which is a nonprofit organization dedicated to defending your rights online. And we have been paying a lot of attention to the GDPR as it has come out, as well as other efforts to instill a right to be forgotten in Europe and elsewhere.
My name is Amy Stepanovich. I'm the executive director of Silicon Flatirons at Colorado Law School. In a previous life, and by previous life I mean 4 weeks ago, 5 weeks ago, I was the U.S. policy manager at an international tech policy organization called Access Now. We had offices in a lot of different places, including in Brussels. And the people who work out of that Brussels office had been really, really involved in the passage of the General Data Protection Regulation in Europe, or GDPR. In case you hear that, you're going to hear that acronym a lot in this panel. So that's what it is. It is the update from a 1995 European law on data protection in Europe. And so we came out of that process, and I had been working on data protection legislation in the United States, which for the first time looked like it was going to be possible, still does. And this conversation was really at the heart of some of those conversations. So.
Good morning. My name is Duane Gatesel. I'm a lawyer in Austin, Texas. I deal with intellectual property matters. And thank you for coming. At 10 a.m., I'm reminded, plus with the topic, of the song Last Dragon Con, which seems apropos. Can't believe that I forgot, am I in the Marriott?
Okay, so the topic of the panel is the right to be forgotten in the U.S. There is no right to be forgotten in the U.S. Panel's over. Have a nice day.
Thank you.
But obviously the topic is whether we should, and what can we do to get there, and where are we in other circumstances. So I think the best place to start is, Kurt, Amy, why don't one of you give the background of the European right to be forgotten and the GDPR, and let us know where we are.
This is one of my favorite little rants to give, so you're all in for a true treat. You're going to be super bored. I'm really interested in this. So the right to be forgotten, even though it is called a singular right, is actually two separate rights in one, and it's really important, and my time spent in D.C. was spent yelling and screaming and begging people to stop calling it one single right. One of the rights is called the right to erasure, and that right is basically to be able to go to Facebook or Twitter or any other company that you have a relationship with on the internet and say, I no longer want to have this relationship with you. I want you to delete all of the data that you have on me. And that right has been fairly non-controversial. With some extent, I mean, nuance and how it's implemented, et cetera, there have been some exceptions. But that right, people firmly believe almost that you should be able to leave a service and take, have them erase the information that you gave them as part of being a member of that service. The other right, and the right that this panel is going to talk about, I think, probably in greater depth, is the right to delist. And that has been very controversial in Europe. It's been brought up in other places around the world. And in the U.S., I believe the argument is going to be it's not constitutional. And what that right says is that you can go to a search engine or any place that indexes and retrieves results from searches and say, I do not want certain results to be shown when somebody searches for my name. So it doesn't take any content off the internet. It doesn't remove them that content from coming up in other searches for other names or other items, but it disconnects a search result from a person's name. And it can only in Europe be applied, or it's only supposed to be applied. Implementation is, again, important here. If it's not a newsworthy topic. So it's supposed to be things like maybe bad activities you got into as a child, and it's influencing your ability to get a job or get an apartment, taking those items and making them so they don't show up permanently in your search results when somebody looks at your name. So two separate rights. By putting them together, we make this right to erasure in the U.S. seem really controversial, and we hurt our chances of getting that right put into law. So I like to level set by saying, let's separate them out. I'm happy to answer, and in my previous job, I spent a lot of time looking at the right to erasure and how to implement it and how to write it, because there's a lot of information that you give to companies online, and some of that maybe you shouldn't be able to delete. But on the other hand, the right to delist has become super controversial. And so we're going to talk, I think, about why that may or may not be something that can be used in the United States. And if it is something that we want to see, how maybe it could be implemented properly to comply with the Constitution.
All right. Can I? Okay. So,
but we're all awake here, right?
Yeah. Good. So the right to be forgotten, again, I'm going to, just because it's easier for the panel and easier to say it, we're going to keep using it, even though you're going to kick me, I'm sure.
I can't reach you.
But the right to be forgotten, it does exist in the EU. But it expressly does not exist outside the EU. Google was just awarded a court victory that said that, Google was awarded a court victory to not have to deal with any issues outside of the EU. Basically, all they do is ban content based on your region and say, if you're in the EU, you can't see this, but it's still listed everywhere else. They're not actually doing any work. So that's, it does exist, but that's why it's not here. And again, why it's not here is basically the Constitution question. I think there's other questions and lobbying points and courses that are on both sides. But the primary issue against the delisting is the First Amendment. I mean, the right to speech and freedom of speech. So that's the teeter-totter of the issue. Is what rights are we trying to protect? So, Kurt, I know the EFF certainly has opinions.
We do. I think this is one of the things that the right to be forgotten, or the delisting right that Amy just talked about, creates, you can see some examples where, it's just value. There's a picture from your college days that reflects perhaps not who you would like employers to see right now. You'd like that picture to go down. There's aspects of your life that you've moved on from and you want to be able to successfully move on. Wouldn't it be great that information is not there forever? And that's sort of the idea that was generating it. And to put that sort of into context, there's a bit of a realization that as technology has become ubiquitous, people are taking pictures of everything and then putting them online, that there is just a tremendous information about somebody, and you may have made some bad decisions about the viewability of that kind of information. There's another piece of it, which is, there might be actual, criminal information of your past that you might not want to, you served your time, you paid your debt to society, and you don't want that information to be found. But there's also an application of it, which is very, very disturbing, which is when people are removing things from being findable that would actually be useful for other people to know. For example, if a politician starts to run for office and doesn't want the voting public to know that they were engaged in fraud many years ago, or obviously trying to get the fraud information going down. One of the first exposures I had to this right was an attempt to get Wikipedia to remove information about how someone had committed a rather dastardly murder. And you know, you could say that might actually be useful information for someone else to know that this person has, you know, committed a murder in the past. So that's sort of like some of the policy issues that come into play. Here in the U.S., there is also the First Amendment issue that stopping someone from saying truthful information runs up against the First Amendment. In many cases, actually, even not truthful information, or opinion speech is allowed. But anyway, this is about facts, and if you remove those facts and require someone to remove those facts, you are infringing upon the First Amendment rights. And the First Amendment rights are also held by the companies who are hosting it. In Europe, they're sort of like the delisting is trying to address a little bit of that that concern, saying, "Well, we're not removing it." So the news article, for example, is still up, but it's being delisted, so you can't go to Google and find it. And that's an interesting compromise because making something unfindable has a very
harder to find.
Yeah, I'm going to go with unfindable because I think most people are not that good at using non-search engines to find things, and maybe it's not 100% that they're not found, but it's really hard for people to find, especially if they don't know where they're supposed to be looking.
That's true. People pay me to Google because they don't know how to do it.
And this, so it has a profound effect on how widely information will be known and spread, which is the idea. And I'm not sure that it doesn't satisfy my freedom of expression concerns to have something which is available but is extraordinarily hard to find.
So why I say harder to find is, again, I said it has to be connected to the name. So if somebody says murder in Atlanta, the murder in Atlanta would still come up. But if they wrote in Amy Stepanovich, it wouldn't necessarily came up that I killed Kurt in Atlanta.
Coming up soon.
Future right to be forgotten application. So it was, like I said, you could still search for it in a search engine. It would still be there. By the way, I actually don't necessarily agree with the right to be forgotten. So a lot of these positions I've taken here are going to be really interesting for me. But it is harder. You can't do it based on a name. So, and most people, if they're going to do a job background search, if any of you have done online dating and you want to search for the person in the online dating profile and see if they're a murderer, that might be important to somebody.
I'm supposed to put that in my online dating profile?
Not you.
No, I would put not a murderer on there. Which,
oh, shoot, hang on.
But the... the Wikipedia example is a really good one because that is a totally wrong application. Like, that is not... Wikipedia is not a search engine or an indexer. That information is not, they were being asking to remove it. They weren't asking to delist it. Like, that is a totally wrong application of this right. And when I get into implementation, the reason is that there are a lot of companies that are allowing right to be forgotten requests that are wrong, that are like blatantly wrong, that are punitive, and that are influencing journalism. And now what the reason for that might be because GDPR has super high fines and they just want to like do whatever they're asked to do to avoid the possibility of those fines. It could be that they don't like this law, so they've discovered that if they over comply that people get really mad about this right to be forgotten, because the headlines don't say company screws up implementation of right to be forgotten, because nobody would click on that headline on Twitter. Nobody in this room would be like, eh. Well, you would. You're like lawyers would. But the, what it says is right to be forgotten requires information about politician having sex with cat to be removed from the internet. And people click on that headline and you're like, wow, this right to be forgotten is awful. Why do I not get to know what this politician did? And that implementation question really gets to it, because you see it all the time with GDPR in general. Most of the headlines about how GDPR is bad are how companies have implemented GDPR in a bad way.
I think you raise a good point about the fines, and I think it's good to provide a perspective for the audience who might know Yes, the fines can go up to 4% of your annual revenue, which for like a company like Facebook or Google, that's a fair amount of money. I mean, they recently had Facebook had a $5 billion fine and shrugged it off, so maybe they're okay with that. But it does create an incentive to err on the side of compliance, and or maybe it's more the trying to show how bad it is. But the speech effect of it is that there are things that are being removed that shouldn't be.
One of the problems with any type of law like this, the problems that Kurt addressed of what information are you going to be taking down and what's left up, and the issues with how do you implement that, all come down to the question of how do you make a law that works. I mean, ignoring the First Amendment questions, as we talked about, if anybody was in the Assange panel yesterday, as we talked about with the Espionage Act, the laws get written in a way that tend to be very broad and sweeping, so that we can capture what we're all trying to capture without having to name every particular thing that we think should be addressed. And the reason that becomes problematic then is then it's up to somebody else to figure out whether what you're doing is actually part of it falls under the law. Can I take down the information about me being drunk at Dragon Con in 2019 if I want my boss to not see that?
No.
Probably not, because that's too new. Can I take down that information about me being drunk in 2009? Well, maybe not. Maybe if you're looking to hire me, you want to know what I do. Maybe if I'm running for office, you want to know that I've been at that many Dragon Cons and you see those pictures. So those are the kinds of things that, where do we draw the line and where do we balance that list? And that's the challenge of drafting laws, is to find something that gives people enough guidance but doesn't capture the stuff that it shouldn't. And frankly, politicians are bad at it. And writing laws is difficult, and that's why we end up with all these horrible unintended consequences that we then find ourselves dealing with down the line.
I'm curious about your perspective, because California has a limited erasure law, and New York tried to implement one last year. It looked like it died in committee. How do you reconcile what those states have tried to do with respect to the First Amendment and free speech concerns?
So I think the one aspect of the approach is to look at it. I think this is the right to erasure is different than the being able to take back what you have given, and so like putting it through withdrawing the consent that had previously been there, and I think that this is a little bit less troubling to me if it is somebody who has basically stored their information with somebody else, with a company, and is pulling back that information from the company. Now, it could be that there nevertheless are expression issues involved, but for most of those cases, for like social media, it is you are using the platform for your own expression, and the platform is not independently making an expression out of that. It could vary. And I think, for example, there are in the lobby there. There's a big screen where it puts up pictures of things happening around people who Instagram out to a particular hashtag, and it goes up. So in that sense, Dragon Con is making an expressive use of those photos. I could see a First Amendment argument that they should be able to continue to use that for that expressive purpose. But for the sort of the typical case of a social media company, there seems to be something different about removing your consent and saying, I want to have my information back, versus going to a newspaper and saying, get rid of that article about me in the archive. Mm-hmm. That would be like the ultimate case of a First Amendment kind of problem, or delisting even in the United States.
Well, it's a small group and a big topic, so I'd say, we can sit here and talk all day, and we will,
But why don't we just go ahead and get some questions and answers going and see where it goes.
So looking around the room, I see that most of us here are old enough that you know, the stupid stuff we did as young people was probably not captured and immortalized forever. However, you know, I look at my kids and their peers, and it seems that they are overshare. And you know, if it didn't go on Twitter or Instagram, it didn't happen. How do you see, you know, as those people age and grow into adulthood? I mean, we've already seen like the Virginia governor and some other cases where, you know, stupid college pranks have come back 30 years after the fact to embarrass them. In the future, is it just going to be like, oh yeah, everybody's got, you know, stupid pictures in their old Instagram feed, who cares? Or is it going to be, you know, a disaster that, you know, if you haven't been super careful about what you post, you're going to be unemployable?
How, you don't have to raise your hand. How many people in here have something that they've written or was written about them or a photo that they've taken that they may not want the whole world to be able to access? I want you to think about that just for a little bit. Personally, I don't think I've ever admitted this publicly before. In high school, there was an I Hate Amy Stepanovich club. There was a whole group of people who did not like me so much. I was in the drama team. We were very dramatic. I don't necessarily want that stuff on the internet and able to be searched by all my future employers. Now, there's an interesting degree of privilege here that I want to introduce. That stuff would never come up if you search my name. It's not on the internet, but it also would never come up if you search my name, because I have been in the news so much since then because I do things like this that it's like 30 pages back on Google. How many people have ever gone past like page 5 of Google search results?
Nice. There's a page 2.
So I have the privilege of this not mattering. But for people who are limited purpose, like, and it's not even that they pulled a college prank, it's that maybe somebody in college wrote something really dehumanizing about them. And like put their name up, and they don't want that to come up. Mm-hmm. There, I mean, I can think of a zillion right. examples of this. And so we have to figure out what type of future we want, and we have to do it in a way that respects the equities involved here. And that's, legislation is really freaking hard. We were writing the right to erasure, and that was what I was working on when I left my job. Think about the information, just we'll use Facebook as an example because it's easy. There's the posts that you write. There's the photos that you put. Like, there's the things that you give Facebook. Then there are the things your friends give Facebook about you. Mm-hmm. I have posted something and tagged somebody else in that post. That is not your content, but it is nonetheless about you. Photos that people post about you with you in them. Then there's all the information Facebook has said, like, here's the information you've given us. Let's run some algorithms against this and make some determinations about who we think you are based on that information. Then maybe information they get from third parties that, like, you have to address in a law on the right to erasure which of those categories of information the person should be able to erase and which ones they shouldn't be able to erase. And that's a hard problem. So it's good that we're talking about this now because we don't have this right in the United States. We are starting to get it at the state level. What do we want that to look like, and what are the things that we're going to want to have or not have reflected in that?
You know, and I think to some extent the answer to what about our kids and everything they're putting online? I obviously, I'm old and crotchety, and I think that's just a terrible lifestyle choice, and I discourage everyone from doing it. But I think that the flip side is also likely to be true. Everybody up here has a Google page that probably you'll never find anything embarrassing, just because we've got too much other stuff drowning it out. Well, the same is true. If you post every sandwich you've ever eaten, then finding the embarrassing picture of you, yeah, it'll be there, but it might be buried under every sandwich you've ever eaten. So maybe it's actually going to be a self-solving problem to that extent. Well, It depends. I mean, again, are we talking about people hunting for information about you, or are we talking about people coming across information? I mean, I do Google people I'm going to think about employing. Of course I do. But I don't Google very hard. I just want to make sure that, you know, all I'm seeing is sandwiches and not your, you know, Nazi group. So...
Yeah, so started to talk a little bit about the types of information, where it's transferred, things like that. A lot of people talk about the right to be forgotten or right to erasure in regards to the data that's being stored or backed up or whatever, but not necessarily that data that's being fed through like machine learning models and things like that. Is there any discussion going on in regards to what to do with that? Because technically, that's very difficult to get rid of.
Well, in some sense, I mean, like under the GDPR, right, it's saying that you have the right to get the personal data erased, and then if the processor you're talking to has, or the controller has other processors who are using that data, that they're supposed to continue this on downstream for everybody that has received that, and it doesn't have an exception for using it for machine learning. There are some exceptions where if there is another lawful basis to process the information, then removing your consent or asking to get it removed because the purpose no longer exists can be exercised, but if they have another lawful basis, they can continue to use it. And the one potential thing about this is it's a legitimate purpose. That a lawful basis that is not fully defined under the GDPR is having a legitimate interest in processing the data. And so I think we're going to have to see over time how that gets understood and whether someone could say, well, so to make my algorithm work, I have a legitimate interest in this, and I have balanced out the rights as the GDPR requires and come to the conclusion that I get to keep the data.
It took about 200 years between the creation of postal services and the laws being passed where you could send anything over the mail. We're still trying to figure out 150 years later how the telephone needs to be used. Why would we expect something to be solved with internet just, 20 years old? Is it something which we are thinking we will solve now, or we're just building up the basis and trying to see what will happen in 100 years?
A deep philosophical question there.
I would say, you know, you gotta strive. That we're trying to make a brighter future, and we're trying to make a brighter future as soon as we can. And it may take 100 years to figure all things out, at which point we'll be really confused about how to deal with a technology that we can't think of right now.
Right.
But, you know, you always try and make the world a better place by thinking through the issues, trying to balance out the equities and do your best you can. If it turns out it's not working, try and see what other changes can be made. But I think it's important for all of us to try to find out what will be the right set of policies and the right balancings of things to make for that brighter future soon.
Well, and we deal more with third parties now. Like, you used to send a letter and you knew what you wrote and the person had a record of it. And that was about it. Now you send a letter and, you know, Gmail potentially has it and they can store it forever. And so you're giving a lot of, you put a file on Dropbox and Dropbox has that file now. You have a Facebook message and Facebook, like, you have a lot of third parties involved there and they can store that forever because that's the processing we've gotten at this point. And so I think if we don't, with that in mind and the fact that technological change is the speed and the rate is picking up so fast, it's more, we have more obligations to think through these things faster, which is not an excuse to get them wrong or to have like all these negative consequences because we're overreaching or doing things that are bad. But it does mean that we need to be thinking really hard and having nuanced, in-depth conversations that aren't necessarily as up here as down here.
One thing.
It's exactly like obscenity laws in the postal services where you could not send anything before the border. We're stepping on the same, I mean, not exactly the same problem. We don't understand something, and we're trying to create laws.
Yeah, one thing I would add to that, it's kind of analogous, and I'm dating myself here, but when I first started practicing, the internet didn't exist. And in trademark law, you're dealing with a lot of policy, piracy, and you know, cyber squatters and people taking trademarks and that sort of thing. So when the internet came around, the courts had no idea how to deal with trademark infringement on the internet. If someone registered a domain name and it was Panavision, for example, famous case, and this one guy had registered hundreds and thousands of domain names, including photos of the city of Pana, Indiana, that he then got Panavision and tried to pass it off. And courts didn't know. And it took probably 10 years for there to be some consensus on how do we handle this sort of thing from a technology standpoint, married with the trademark side of things. So I think, you know, to your point, yes, this is all kind of new. And courts and legislatures and everyone, we're all trying to figure this out and how do you apply that. And I think it probably will over time, but it does take time because I've seen it in the past with respect to that.
I'd like to ask about the idea that children who can't buy tobacco or alcohol or sign a legal contract, but they can give up huge quantities of information about themselves, and other people can also give up information about them, and it's there forever. And I just don't think, I think we need to think very carefully about how to protect people who can't make good decisions yet. And I'd like to extend that argument a little bit and think about the fact that a lot of adults gave information. They knew they were giving information to Facebook, for example. They were giving their posts, they were giving their photographs. I don't think a lot of people understood how much inference, statistical inference, was taking place behind the scenes, and they were giving up huge quantities of information about themselves that they did not understand. They didn't consent to, I don't feel. So I'd just like to ask about that.
Oh, I want to mention one thing on the point about children. Under U.S. law, there are there's the Children's Online Privacy Protection Act. You're talking about like the age at which you can, you know, buy tobacco or buy alcohol. The age for the protections under the Children's Online Privacy Protection Act, COPPA, is 13. So if you're under 13, there are some rules that are not in place for over 13, designed to basically, you need to get parental consent for a lot of things. There's that interzone there. The other piece, though, I think of probably even the harder question is when someone else posts information about you and whether you can have sort of a right to prevent them from posting that information at you. Under the First Amendment, under the U.S. legal tradition, you're really not able to stop people from prevent people from posting truthful information about you, especially if it's just, you know, that's, in a privacy sense, that's often what you're really worried about is facts. Defamation is a different issue. So, yeah, if somebody posts something about you, there's not much you can do besides ask them to take it down. And then you have a complex, our general answer for the children is parental consent. A lot of parents are the ones who are posting the pictures of their children before their children have any idea what it is, and then all their baby pictures are online, and maybe that's not what they want to have forgotten later, but it creates the issue.
I mean, I still don't know all the inferences. I'm a fairly sophisticated technology user, and I still don't know all the inferences that are being made about me from what I post, so I don't think that's a past tense scenario. I think it's present tense, and I think it goes from all the way down all the way up. The sophistication of those algorithms is getting really, really good, for lack of a better word. And so it's really hard to know what information you're giving up. If I'm just saying, like, I ate a sandwich today, all of a sudden they think, like, I'm depressed and have PTSD and live in Arizona and make $190,000 a year, and this is all not, like, where is that line being drawn?
Well, what we thought we were giving up, or even if we understood what those algorithms were when we signed up for a service 10 years ago or 5 years ago, aren't what they are anymore. I mean, it's such a moving target.
And even if you did understand, I mean, think about it. Whoever reads, you know, when Apple sends you the thing, you know, click to agree. I mean, who's going to sit and read 15 pages of fine print? Everybody, yeah, fine, whatever. Yeah, I agree, fine, whatever. So, I mean, we're all agreeing to that. It's like, yeah, just give me the service. You know, just give me the service. Click, click, click. But when you actually read it, I mean, to your point, yeah, you're giving up all of these rights and all this information, but people, me included, I'm not going to sit and read through all
right.
that.
Right. And this is a much larger challenge, but I think a big challenge, which is if we move towards a model where consent is extraordinarily important, then you'll be asked for your consent all the time, and there's this possibility of consent fatigue, basically, that you'll be so often asked for your consent, and you just want to, like, do the thing, and so, yeah, and you have all this click-through. So one of the things that I think is actually very interesting about the approach done in the GDPR and other data protection ideas is the notion that you can then later withdraw that consent. And as things have been done here in the U.S. for a long time, once you've given over your information to a third party, then it's kind of theirs to do with as they will. This has moved around a little bit, that if you're using it in new and different ways, you may have to ask for consent again, and like Facebook got some trouble with the FTC, and that resulted in them having to get consent again. But the notion that you could come back and say, you know, I'm done. You know, whatever it is you provided me, I've gotten, and so let's be done now. Is a good bulwark against that, just sort of having it consented to and forevermore.
So I'm responsible for implementing GDPR in my company. So I'm balancing.
I'm sorry.
Oh, yeah. Sorry about that.
So I'm balancing data collection that we need from European citizens, but also data retention requirements from U.S. federal regulations. As we go forward and states like California, Colorado consider moving in this direction, what kind of implication do you see for us in the United States? And do you see that becoming is that really a possibility that we're going to move that route?
I see privacy becoming a really cool business model for the first time in a long time. There are almost every company, I'm not in the corporate space, so let me not speak in generalities, has regulations from a lot of different jurisdictions that they comply with. Even in the tech space, the data breach notification, so when your information gets accessed by an unauthorized party, and the company has to tell you about that, so like all those notices that say we did a bad thing and your password or your social security number, et cetera, got breached. There are 50 different laws in the unit. Every state has its own law. So they're all different. So I do see the possibility that there are going to be a lot of different standards. We might want to think about what that means for us here. And if we want some limited degree of what is called preemption. Preemption is the concept that the federal government can pass a law and negate any law passed at the state level in favor of the federal law. This is a key question happening in the privacy space right now. If we passed a federal law, should it have preemption at all? Which would get to potentially this California privacy law, but also Illinois has a biometric privacy law. So does Texas. There are different state level privacy laws. It could be so expansive if we decided to make preemption really broad in a privacy law. It could overrule abortion laws, civil rights laws. I mean, really, the way you write this is super important. So we have to say, if we do want to have preemption, what specifically do we want preemption to apply to, and how do we write that? Or do we want it at all? Or do we want states to be able to innovate and to respond to the needs of their citizens? And that would be really hard for you. But potentially companies would pop up, like payroll companies. There are a lot of contractors that people bring in, and they do certain things for that company. And so potentially you could see a data protection third party that you pay a small fee to every month, and they make sure that you're in compliance with all of the data protection laws. And I'm seeing that as the future, quite frankly.
You might have already kind of answered parts of this with what you've said, since I thought of asking this question a little while ago. When your example of, like, something you really didn't wish wasn't out there being back on page 30, so it's kind of hidden. actually, if there is a right to be forgotten law in place, requesting it to be removed actually shines a light on it. Any sort of mitigations in mind when drafting this to deal with the fact that requesting something to be forgotten actually attracts people's attention, especially if you're a more public figure?
So the right to be forgotten shouldn't apply to things that are newsworthy, which is relevant here, because nobody is going to write a story about somebody having a search result taken down necessarily that doesn't comply with that. Now, that might be an overbroad statement. I'm going through this as I'm talking, so I hope you guys will all bear with me. That might be overbroad. There are also these requests are supposed to be between the individual and the company. Unfortunately, because the stories that we're seeing are so clearly abuses of this law, people going after news sites, people going after certain stories, lots of politicians going after stories about them from the past. And so those requests are clearly newsworthy in a way because they're getting to the abuse of the standard. And I think that's why we're seeing it. I'm not sure that we'll see it. And if it becomes the regular process and it's just this request, like a DMCA request between a person and a company. And again, the content's not coming down. So it's really just that search result showing up when somebody looks for your name. And search results change all the time. All the time.
I think there is a tension involved with this that about transparency, that a useful thing that when material is removed from the internet to have transparency about the process by which it got removed. But if you have transparency about something that you're trying to get forgotten, then it just moves from being in one search result to a transparency report, and that may not achieve like the objective. Though as Amy says, like it for somebody who's worried just about people casually finding information about them, that may achieve their result. And so sort of you hope that. I should say the phenomenon you're talking about a bit is called the Streisand effect, right? That if you bring attention, try and suppressing information brings more attention to it. But it's also noteworthy that the Streisand effect is called that because Barbara Streisand did it, who was already quite famous, and you could, in that sense, being famous ahead of time makes it much more newsworthy that you're trying to remove information.
The Stevens effect.
To your point, Amy, about, Gmail, for example, using all your things, you're just trying to email yourself or somebody else, like your taxes or whatever it is. I'm wondering what each of you are doing and advising your friends and family to do to try to limit as much of your potentially private or whatever you think is your private information being used in ways you don't want it to be used.
I've gone the opposite direction. I've just assumed that I have zero privacy in any situation, whatever, and I'm a boring old guy anyway. So for that, I mean, I've actually just sort of taken the position that I've clicked so many of those buttons along the way that I assume everything I've ever done, thought, or known is now owned by Google, and it's just the way it is. I advise people not to. I tell people, read those things, but I don't read them. So, it's definitely a concern, but I think that my personal response has just been that privacy is now a figment of our imagination.
Well, I have to struggle. I'm not a privacy nihilist, and we should go not gently into that good night. Rage against the dying of the light.
But I'm not just old, I'm boring.
We'll find something interesting in there. I think, it's very tough with Gmail. Gmail is ubiquitous as a email program. I don't generally use Gmail as an account to like send mail or to receive it. But I often correspond with people who are on Gmail, right? And so and both parties to the email will have copies. So it's kind of it's kind of hard because if you really want to like have no Google in your life, you have to also not interact with anybody who has Google, and like you'll have a hard time even finding those people. You know, there are other things you can do if you're trying to have more communications privacy. You can use encrypted communications means. Encryption on email is a little can be hard to operate. There are some methods, PGP, but it's a bit of a pain. You can use a messaging service like Signal. Or you know WhatsApp, set disappearing messages. So there are sort of there are ways to communicate something privately. But if you're just operating out in your ordinary course of things, yeah, there's going to be a ton of information that's collected in the course of it.
I always recommend a degree of intentionality in these decisions because there are like yes. Gmail has some privacy issues, and I don't want to downplay, like, they're significant. And that's why I'm pushing for a privacy law, because I think that you should have some rights in regard to the information that companies keep, because I think that's the best response to all of this. But Gmail is also mass market scale, one of the most secure and safest email providers you can use. They are really good at spotting spam. You're not going to necessarily, it will have a harder time phishing you, so getting you to click on a malicious link. They're fairly good security from third parties who are not Google. They keep that information safe and accessible only to them. They now say that they don't scan your email anymore because they have such large volumes of information they don't actually need to scan the content of your email anymore, which is scary in its own right, but you know, you benefit on the back end, I guess. So, I mean, making sure you know what is important to you and you're doing that. Internet of Things objects, as I spoke about that earlier, knowing what sensors you're putting into your house and what information they can collect, what information they can send to people, who, and what happens if they get hacked or used by a third party. The Ring device, the stories coming out of Florida with the Ring and law enforcement right now, if you're not reading them, they're appalling. And all of that stuff is written into Ring's Terms of Service, so that 15-page document that nobody reads, it's in there saying, like, we will just give information over to the police. We don't have to tell you about it. We're just going to give it over to them and not require a court order unless it's information you've tried to erase. Which, by the way, if there's information you've tried to erase that Ring is turning over to the police, it means that they didn't erase it. So have a approach these decisions with a degree of intentionality. Which is not to say that you are not in power in this situation and we need a law. So I think eventually we're going to need some protections here because the power dynamic is so slanted in terms of the companies that there is a, I understand privacy nihilism, but I think we can still fix it and come back.
As for me, I kind of look at social media like that Christmas gift you got when you were a kid, that it's really cool for a few weeks and then you put it aside and you never play with it again. That's my own personal philosophy. And I have two daughters, and so I've tried to get them also to, you know, not post every enchilada that you've ever had in any taco place, you know, throughout the country. Let some things go. And try to explain privacy and all that kind of stuff. And this is generally the response I get. Whatever. So, you know, you can advise people, you can tell them, look, like Amy said, be intentional, think about it. Just like I would advise clients, just because you're mad, don't hit send immediately. You know, think about it. Post something, maybe wait a day before you post something on Facebook or Instagram or whatever. It doesn't have to go up that very second. So that then with some reflection, you can think, maybe I don't want to see that, you know, next week, next year, next decade. And I think that would solve at least a lot of the embarrassment issue.
So on the other end of it, how does a concern for privacy relate to the suppression of legitimate information? For example, as a voter, I used to go out to the newspaper or to the website of the League of Women Voters. They had a series of questions that the same questions they asked every person who was running for that particular office, and I would go through and I printed it out and I laid it out on the dining room table. I was notorious. And highlight all of that. The last time I went out there, huge blanks. Now, whether these people were so arrogant that they thought that I was going to vote for them because they were certain political party or whether they were afraid to answer the questions, it removed me from making an informed choice.
All right. I mean, as I understand it, with something like the voter guides that are produced by the League of Women Voters and other organizations, that they're providing the questions to all the candidates, but the candidates are not, you know, required to answer the questions. And so if there were blanks in it, it may be just that the candidates have chosen not to answer that spot.
Kind of going back to Amy's statement about, you know, the distinction between newsworthy and not newsworthy. I mean, it might, let's say 20 years ago, the fact that Donald Trump and Jeffrey Epstein hung out was probably not newsworthy. They're two private individuals, they're billionaires, whatever. Today, it sure as hell is newsworthy. You know, other types of examples where somebody might, you know, go to delete information prior to stepping into public life that could be relevant once they're in public life.
So the information is not deleted. It's still there. So that photo would still be there. Now, you might not have a reason to request it to be delisted prior to it becoming newsworthy. I don't know if the photo that you're referencing, there would have been any move to take that down.
But for what it's worth, that photo was like in gossip magazines at the time. So, I mean, it was newsworthy if you consider gossip to be newsworthy. But I think it was your general point.
And then at the time, because the content's still up there, people can re-report on it. So you can go back and find it again. And it's a delisting, so you have to have both names. So if there are multiple names in the photo, I could search for Jeffrey Epstein or Donald Trump. And if only one of them did it, it would come up on the other one. Gossip pages, if people are just going through the old gossip page. There are a lot of ways to find this information that are not searching for the name. Again, not necessarily that we want to have the fully right to be forgotten, right to delist that they have in Europe, but there are ways to combat issues like that where you're talking about things that are not newsworthy once and then become newsworthy because the content is still there.
Yeah, I think there's a related issue. So if we're going to flip into the right of erasure, where you are pulling back the materials that you yourself had previously posted, yeah, I can imagine that a lot of politicians, or if they're thinking about becoming politicians, might go carefully comb through their prior social media posts and start deleting things. And I've even seen some examples where people have looked back at tweets of people who we're running for office, and they're deleted and things like that. Someone has cleaned up a little bit, but I think that is sort of a different set of issues from stopping another person from saying that about you. So, in such a case, one can perhaps remove the photos that you had previously posted, but if somebody else took a photo of you, then you wouldn't be able to remove that with the delisting. With the right to erasure. Excuse me.
I guess I have a question about the threshold for what counts as newsworthiness. Like you brought the thing about the gossip, tabloid. I guess where does that lie? Is it defined? I guess maybe in Europe, maybe they have a better definition of it. And how could it maybe apply to the United States?
Well, that's what I was talking about earlier with the question creation of these kinds of laws. The problem is that you say something's newsworthy, but then someone has to make that determination of these fact-specific instances. Is this a newsworthy thing? And what's newsworthy today? And newsworthy to whom? And for what purposes? That's part of what makes these things challenging to draft.
Well, I think it's also worse than that, because it is a dangerous thing to have the government, in the form of legislation or maybe through judicial interpretation, decide what is newsworthy. Because if that is something that has a major effect on things, then that's giving a lot of power over what can be suppressed and what cannot be suppressed. Be that as it may, I think this does come up in some areas of law in the U.S., like in defamation context, in private public disclosure of private facts. You can sue someone over that in many jurisdictions. A question arises is whether the person is a public figure or a limited purpose public figure. And so this is not really so much about whether the news itself is newsworthy, but whether the person is someone who is in the public eye. And there's general purpose public figures, you know, so a politician would be easily one of those. And then there are limited purpose public figures who are people who are public figures because of a particular thing that they have done, but not about every aspect of their lives. So that is one of the attempts to balance that issue.
And I, for one, would rather have the judges doing that, despite what Kurt said. I don't want necessarily companies making that decision where they can make it on one-offs and each company can have their own standard. We have, at Access Now, who is no longer a we, Access Now has said that companies shouldn't be forced to take content off the internet unless a judge says that it falls afoul of some law. And there should be a neutral standard that can be applied, I think, from a judiciary that you can look at and you can see and you can understand what the standard is potentially, and it's public and it's applied to everybody because it's jurisdiction based, and I would rather see that than individual one-off company standards which you may never have any transparency into at all.
Just to be clear, I'm not suggesting that judges shouldn't be involved in this and you shouldn't have a court order.
But it does raise the issue though, right, Kurt? I mean, at the end of the day, you know, you talk about defamation and you talk about public disclosure cases, but those are, I mean, the issue of whether or not you're newsworthy comes up as part of the litigation.
Well, what I was trying to say is that where it comes up mostly is in the context of whether you are a public figure, but right, not about whether or not this is a newsworthy piece of information. Whether,
right.
So, like, an interested public makes for a public interest, as a way of putting it. That what is something that is protected by the First Amendment is not about as much a judgment of what the information itself is, but whether the person is in the public eye that we can report about them.
Right. Well, I would say the issue I have is, again, you bring those issues in a litigation, you have that discussion, it's decided or not. But when we're talking about right to erasure, right to delisting, we're talking about, you know, sending a form to a company. So again, there we come out where is the, you can have courts provide oversight as to what ought to be delisted, ought to be, at the end of the day, it's all gonna be implemented by that poor guy over there. And he's the one who's gonna have to make the decision about whether I'm newsworthy or not, so.
We are at time, but we do have one more question. Do you want to keep going, or y'all want to wrap up?
We can answer one more.
So I think more and more coming to the realization that a lot of people just don't care at all, or if they do care, they care for an hour and a half until they go home and they, you know, looking at something else in regards to privacy. Is there a good, what are the next steps in trying to kind of show people what's actually happening and maybe bring it more to the forefront?
I think people care more than people think they care. I think it's, I mean, you see this in politics. How much time do you have to devote to something that isn't immediately relevant and tangential to your life? And that's, again, another reason we're pushing for a law, is you should have more power to do things. But a lot of the studies, Dana Boyd has done really amazing studies, particularly with young people who often are the target of these accusations that they don't care and that they just post everything. And they care a great deal. They're probably more sophisticated than any of us are. The context that they put into what they share and how they share information is amazing. And I think that's just growing as the generations come up more and more intertwined with technology. We care for an hour and then we have to go about our lives because we have lives and we have bills to pay. So let's give the people the tools they need in the instance that they have them to be able to operate those, because it shouldn't be something that somebody like me who spends all day every day thinking about privacy or used to can't even deal with it. Nobody else has that time, so I don't expect anybody else to be able to deal with it.
I would advocate for not only transparency, but clear language. You know, yeah, I can get paid, and TJ can get paid to legal it up, But if you have something that's short and plain that anyone can understand, then you probably have more immediate caring and going, oh, wait, I did what? And then there would be some understanding.
And I'll go my normal soapbox, and I'll just remind you that being involved in the process is the best part of the process. What you can do in that hour and a half that you're thinking about it and caring about it is write your congressman, donate to a lobbying group that has your point of view, be involved in creating the law you want to see, and be active and vote when you do.
Yeah, so I just added that. A lot of people in surveys sort of bear this out. If you ask them the question, do they care about their privacy? The answer is yes. And what a lot of the people who are saying people don't care, they're like, well, they just click through this thing, they post that stuff on online, and therefore they don't care. And one of the things that I think is a little bit disturbing about that is conflating when people are not understanding what the privacy settings are or expectations are with not caring about privacy. So for a lot of examples where people would post things thinking it was going to their friends, but in fact they had a setting that made it public. And so from that you should infer that they had a misunderstanding of what the thing is. We need to solve for that so people understand what they're doing, versus saying, well, that means that they don't really care about their privacy.
And most importantly, do you all have your phones out? Phones? Mm-hmm. Use them to rate us in the DragonCon app. We won't ask for our information to be delisted if you say that we sucked. I promise.
Nice segue.
All right.
Thanks.
Thank you, everybody.
Thank you. Appreciate it.